An important and revealing joint press conference between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin just wrapped up. The two have been meeting today in Helsinki, Finland. On Insight, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins me to talk about that meeting. We're also going to discuss the California Democratic Party and its response currently to the U.S. Senate race. Then Cap Radio Environment reporter Ezra David Romero previews his new limited series podcast titled Yosemite Land. He's going to join us to talk more about the in-depth reporting he's been doing on this national park. We'll also give you an update on the Ferguson fire, which is burning in that area outside of the park. Later in the hour, Sacramento native Jane DeLurie joins Insight to talk about her debut novel, The Balcony. It follows generations of residents in a country manor outside Paris. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. With President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin meeting today in Finland, there have been, as you probably know, special reports throughout the morning and a joint news conference just finished. In that conference, a few of the highlights from President Trump saying there was no collusion, zero collusion were the words he used about the alleged relationship between Russia and the United States during the 2016 election. President Putin responded with, "Can you name a single fact of collusion?" He said, "There is no evidence. It's utter nonsense." Joining us now, as he does almost every Monday, the political junkie Ken Rudin. He is based near Washington, D.C. He, too, has watched this press conference. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Beth. I am exhausted watching this.
Yeah.
Exhausted.
Well, add some more perspective to this meeting. And besides listening to the words, there was the body language. There was the tone of the journalists taking on these two presidents. I think a lot was revealed in this press conference.
Well, I think so, too. I mean, there was so many questions going into the meeting or the summit or whatever you want to call it, given the fact that the president had just spent all his time. The president was talking, basically denigrating NATO allies, complaining that they weren't paying their fair share of defense. He criticized Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, about her Brexit strategy. There was criticism of Germany about the gas lines to Russia. So there was a lot of criticism going into this meeting with Putin, and yet there was nary a criticism of the Russian leader at all, saying, "I hope to have a strong relationship. I trust him. I support him. I think there would be good for our two countries." So once again, it just shows that the president either is doing Putin's bidding. I mean, if you want to take a conspiracy theories a little bit, but there's no question what he's doing is dividing American allies, dividing NATO at the expense of trying to get a stronger relationship with Putin.
I think as you and other people heard, the president, meaning President Trump, had opportunities to step forward boldly and be specific, to criticize, to denounce, to ask for a change in strategy. And there was an expectation, if you're talking about expectations, that he would do that. The fact that he didn't and the fact that he extended blame that could be shared everywhere, I think is one of those statements that, as I said, is not only revealing, but a statement that's going to be heard around the world by allies, too.
Well, you know, something that was interesting, right at the end of the press conference, Anderson Cooper of CNN said his words were, "You've just seen the most disgraceful performance by a U.S. president." In the New York Times this morning, columnist Charles Blow wrote, "Trump is, the words is exact quote, Trump is a traitor and may well be treasonous. There is more and more discussions about what Trump's real goals are and what he's trying to accomplish." That is the kind of word you're hearing out of Charles Blow or Anderson Cooper is unprecedented. But at the same time, it is unprecedented to see the president of the United States asked at a press conference, "Whom do you believe regarding the Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign? Do you believe your own intelligence agencies or do you believe Putin?" And Trump's answer is, what about Hillary Clinton's emails? That was an astounding response. I mean, I'm not describing it exactly word for word, but in essence, that's exactly what happened. He spoke about the server, Hillary's emails, the FBI's malfeasance, nothing about criticizing Russia or Putin.
We'll go back to looking at the video, and every time he brought up the 2016 election, the fact that he won, how big he won by, about the Hillary Clinton campaign, and watch the body language almost eye-rolling by President Putin. He would move his head back, he would shift his body around, and just the level of content, the tone, and the difference between the two presidents was so remarkable. I want to go to a soundbite by President Trump, and this is some of his discussion in that arena of collusion.
There was nobody to collude with. There was no collusion with the campaign. And every time you hear all of these, you know, 12 and 14, it's stuff that has nothing to do. And frankly, they admit these are not people involved in the campaign. But to the average reader out there, they're saying, well, maybe that does. It doesn't. And even the people involved, some perhaps told misstories, although in one case, the FBI said there was no lie. There was no lie. Somebody else said there was. We ran a brilliant campaign, and that's why I'm president. Thank you.
All right. Ken, the important highlight from President Putin about all of that is where President Putin was on this election and who he wanted to win. And that is worth listening to again as he was asked and as he said this.
And did you direct any of your officials to help him do that?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Because he talked about bringing the U.S.-Russia relationship back to normal.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Is him saying that he did, in fact, want President Trump to win. That's what he had been set up for. So it's a little cloudy, not in the context of the entire conversation, but Ken, take it from there because I think you get my point.
Well, yes. Look, in fairness, there is no proof, or at least we haven't seen it from Robert Mueller yet, who is examining this. But there is no proof that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia during the campaign. There's no proof of that. But there seems to be unquestioned evidence that Russia did what it can to defeat Hillary Clinton by the leaking of the DNC emails, by the leaking of the Hillary Clinton campaign staff and campaign manager emails, through everything they did on Facebook and Twitter and social media. It seemed clear that Russia did everything it could to defeat Hillary Clinton with fake tweets and fake posts on social media. So did Trump take advantage of it? Probably. Was he involved in it specifically? That has not been proven. But as far as the question, whom did Moscow prefer in the election, there seems to be no question whatsoever.
Ken, as a political junkie, I'd like to get your opinion on something the president said. He was putting the context of the relationship with Russia into, I guess, the relationship of all time. And he characterized it this way.
But our relationship has never been worse than it is now. However, that changed as of about 4 hours ago. I really believe that. Nothing would be easier politically than to refuse to meet, to refuse to engage, but that would not accomplish anything. As president, I cannot make decisions on foreign policy in a futile effort to appease partisan critics or the media or Democrats who want to do nothing but resist and obstruct.
I couldn't help but think, Ken, how you and the millions of students of history heard that statement by the president, that the relationship has never been worse than it is now up until 4 hours ago.
Well, first of all, I mean, that is one of the things that resulted in the absolute head shaking on my part. It reminded me of what he said with North Korea in Singapore summit with Kim Jong-un, who basically he said that there's no longer a threat. There's no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. And he said this on the basis of a conversation he had with Kim for a couple of hours. To say that, one, that the relationship with Russia has never been worse. And of course, anybody who remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis or anything else in the past, I think it's kind of ridiculous. But the fact is that whatever, how bad it was, he has blamed it on President Obama. But now he's saying that in the last 4 hours, that's suddenly fine. It's all gone away. It's like it's almost a fantasy land response to what this meeting was. I mean, first of all, we have no reporters who were there. We just have the translators. President Trump could say whatever he wants about this conversation. But to say that this is one of the worst relationship we've ever had with Russia, and now because of this conversation in 4 hours, it's all gotten better. It is just remarkable. And again, it's not so much, to me, it's not even how Putin may react to what the president has to say. I'd love to hear what Congress, the response is. Will Republicans continue to serenade the president with whatever he has to say about Russia? I mean, when I saw the House Intelligence Committee go after the FBI last week in such a way that was almost a disgrace and an embarrassment, in its apparent willingness to protect the president, this is the Republican Party that once stood up for something as far as being tough on the Soviet Union, being tough on international relations. And they seem more willing and more eager to protect the president than to protect the United States. It's just, I mean, that's why I think Anderson Cooper called it disgraceful, because there's never been a performance by the president in foreign relations, in my memory, certainly, and a performance by his own party to acquiesce in what the president has been saying, something I've never seen before.
I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and we are referencing a joint press conference that happened within the last, it just wrapped up in about 20 minutes ago, with President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. In answering a question by Reuters journalist Jeff Mason, President Trump said, just to put a final note to what we're talking about here, U.S. foolishness, stupidity, and the Mueller probe caused the breakdown in the relationship. We're all to blame, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, it should have been started, meaning repairing the relationship, before I came into office. And then he took a moment to say the probe is a disaster for our country. To be fair, collusion is only one third of the overall investigation by Robert Mueller.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, as we've seen with so many of the indictments, especially the 12 of the Russian intelligence officials last Friday, it's not all about collusion. And as I said earlier, there may be no collusion. But insofar as what Moscow wanted to happen, the result that the Kremlin was pushing for, it seems no question by all these indictments, by all information, by all accounts by U.S. intelligence agencies that the Russia got the result of the election they had wanted. They wanted Donald Trump. They did not want Hillary Clinton. They did everything they can to ensure that thing. So in some ways, it almost doesn't matter whether Trump worked with the Russians on it. Certainly what the Russians did benefited Trump in every possible way.
Overall, the joint press conference started with this tone of stating the cooperation, the willingness to work together on nuclear disarmament, on anti-terrorism. And in Syria, where President Putin said Syria could be the first showcase example of cooperation, he said, in general, we are glad with the outcome, and I hope we start to understand each other better. So we could spend a lot of... Go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say, think of all the months of the carnage and slaughter that's been going on in Syria, aided and abetted by Moscow.
Years.
So to say that maybe we're coming to some kind of agreement on Syria, it certainly took a long time and a lot of deaths for that to happen.
Until this summit, we would have focused this conversation on the naming of Brett Kavanaugh as President Trump's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. You and I haven't talked since that happened. Can we just do a checkpoint on that? And if there's anything new on the confirmation plan at this point?
Nothing new. Look, the fact is that Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, said that the Democrats are going to do everything they can to make life miserable for Brett Kavanaugh. But I don't see, because there's no longer a filibuster, they don't have the numbers in the Senate, there's no indication that any Republican is going to vote no, and there is an indication that some Democrats may vote yes. I don't see how the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh can be stopped as much as Chuck Schumer and others in the Democratic Party would like it to happen.
Finally, let's talk a little California politics because it's making national news. Longtime Senator Dianne Feinstein getting a whopping no confidence vote from her statewide party. You saw those numbers over the weekend, right?
I don't know if it surprised me. We've seen Dianne Feinstein, as we've seen it when she ran for governor of California in 1990. She was also defeated. But the party was different then. The party was still more moderate than it was now. I mean, maybe Dianne Feinstein was more centrist than she is now. She has certainly moved to the left in response to Donald Trump. Although last year she did say things that she urged Democrats to have patience with Trump, that I could work with him. But obviously, that's probably what started that Kevin DeLeon challenge to her, that, you know, that she was too cautious, too willing to work with Trump, and she did not reflect the anger that many Democrats have. But as we saw during the June primary, remember, Feinstein got 44% of the vote. DeLeon got 12% of the vote. The entire Democratic establishment, seems like, has lined up behind Feinstein. Jerry Brown, Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, others. So, yes, she was embarrassed by the state party over the weekend. Yes, you know, I mean, we're talking about 333 delegates compared to 8.4 million Democrats statewide. I don't think this affects the November election. Maybe it's a blip. Maybe it shows that De Leon is doing better with Latino voters and more progressives. But I still don't see how her reelection to another term is endangered in any way. But she did get a thumping, as you say, at the state convention.
Yeah, let me just cover those numbers. So 217 delegates voted for Kevin DeLeon. He's a Democrat. He's from Los Angeles. 22 only cast ballots for Dianne Feinstein. But there were 94 that voted for no endorsement. She didn't think an endorsement vote should be taken at all. She said the party should just let the voters decide. Going back to the primary, which you mentioned, Kevin DeLeon had about 800,000 votes. Dianne Feinstein had almost 3 million.
And let's not forget about the money in the bank, which is also important. It doesn't always determine the winner. Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump by a lot of money in 2016. But, you know, for the record, Feinstein has about $7 million in the bank. DeLeon maybe has less than $1 million. Perhaps the endorsement over the weekend could bring more money to his coffers, but ultimately, you're not going to give money to somebody who you don't think is going to win. And right now, the polls, I mean, maybe things could have been changing. Maybe the endorsement could help him in some way. But right now, again, with less than 4 months to go before the election, it's hard to see how much he's catching up in time to beat her on November 6th.
And you are right. The endorsement does mean a boost to his campaign financially in that they will spend more money promoting his candidacy this fall. Before I let you go, Ken, let's talk about the other California senator, the new senator, Kamala Harris, which the New York Times has stepped out to say, yeah, she's going to run for president. What do you think?
Look, you know, something, the real question is when somebody says who's running and you have to stop, is it? I mean, yes, it's Elizabeth Warren and there's Bernie Sanders and there's, you know, and Joe Biden. And Joe Biden is 75. Bernie Sanders, I think, is 105. No, of course he's not. But the point is, Kamala Harris is the new blood of the Democratic Party. She seems to be, from everything she says, she seems to be very conscious of her national image and perhaps looking at 2020. So when I think of young Democratic prospects, I think of Kamala Harris. I think of Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York. I think of people like that who are
Cory Booker. You have to add that to
Cory Booker. Certainly, they're winning over new audiences. Do they play nationwide? Do they win in the heartland? Do they get back the voters in Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio? That's the real question. And we have, you know, the midterms in 4 months, and then we have 2 years to go after that to see how much of appeal they have. But right now, they have to be listed as among the front runners. I can't believe we're talking about that word in 2018, but certainly among the front runners for 2020.
Well, put Elizabeth Warren right up there and then repeat your questions about where her candidacy will play to. And yeah, I think it's going to be a fascinating campaign cycle. Donald Trump, just going back to the conference, repeated over and over, where is the server? Where is the server? I don't want to talk about the story and not bring that question up. We don't spend much time on that. But is that a question that's going to get an answer, Ken?
But he's been asking that for where are Hillary Clinton's 33,000 emails? Oh, you know, when people are listening to Trump talk about the server, that has nothing to do with what the intelligence agencies are saying about Russian involvement in 2016. So,
okay, thank you. You just answered it.
Okay. That's what I did.
Exactly what I thought you were going to say. Ken, it's always a pleasure. This is one of those days when we could fill the hour. So thanks for giving us so much time today.
See you next week, Beth.
He is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find a link to his website at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Portions of roadways into Yosemite Valley are closed because of the Ferguson fire, which is only contained by a few percent at this point. It's burning outside the park. It started on Friday. Cap Radio's environment reporter Ezra David Romero spent time in Yosemite earlier this summer. He has immersed himself in many of the issues of this park, and he launches a limited series podcast today titled Yosemite Land. He's in the studio to talk more about the project. Hi, Ezra.
Hey, Beth.
I know this is something you've been very excited about. This fire, as all fires around the park and across the state are, is frightening. So why don't you update the numbers for us at this point?
Yeah, so there's it's about 9,000 acres. It's 2% contained. There's about 500 people working on the fire. And, you know, this is an area that saw a fire last year nearby called the Detweiler Fire that burned, in the end, 81,000 acres, burned about 63 homes, 67 other structures, and one business. It's an area that's, like, very foothilly and brush, but then it meets these steep mountains that go into Yosemite Park, these big ravines, and they're very hard to fight and actually to put people in. And this time of year, we see a lot of brush fires, right, in the lowland, this Mariposa area. And that it's all those foothills with lots of brush. And so that's what's burning at the moment. And then also into these ravine type places.
Fire is certainly part of the ecology of the area and the national park. So when you visit the park and they talk to you about concerns, obviously traffic or the environment, pollution, is fire near the top of that list?
Yeah, I spoke with the fire chief in Yosemite, Kelly Martin, a few weeks ago, and she was talking about how there's been this 100 years of suppression of fire in the forest, in Yosemite, in the area around it. That's something they're actively trying to change. And what that means is they've had this culture of putting fires out, right, because they're nearby where people live, or there's logging happening, things like that. So that means there's a lot of fuel on the ground with brush and trees and things like that. So that's why some of these fires can get really big really fast, because all that is there. And so they're trying to change that by doing prescribed burns and managing the forest in a bit of a different way. But when you have this, when it's a whole-scale forest problem,
right,
they can only do so much at each time. So, right, they're going segment by segment of the forest. Mm-hmm. And so,
and we have so much standing dead timber right now across the state. Let's go to the scope of your reporting. Talk about when you were in Yosemite and what your goals were.
Yeah, so earlier this year, I pitched some stories about Yosemite, and then we had this idea, let's turn this into a podcast. And so there's all these issues in Yosemite. Before I got to the station in November here, I was working in Fresno for about 5 years, and I covered Yosemite often for Valley Public Radio. And so I did a series in the fall of last year on affordable housing in the region and how there's so many Airbnbs in the communities around Yosemite that people who live there are having a hard time finding places to live, and people who live in the park aren't taking jobs because they can't find a place to live there. So I had all this reporting experience, and so we decided let's focus on that a bit. And so our first episode is all about tourism, overpopulation, the idea of sense of place, how things are changing in the park. And so we start off by talking about commercialization and what embodies that more than the new Starbucks opening. And so Freddie Brewster, he's the guy who started a petition against Starbucks opening back in, like, say, February, March. And let's hear a clip from him.
It's not necessarily Starbucks or Aramark. It's the Park Service not really upholding its values and not really being a proper caretaker for conservation purposes.
I asked people on my Facebook and Twitter what they thought about Starbucks opening. Robert Pasillas and Christy Page live near Yosemite and visit often.
I was shocked to be in Yosemite Valley and to see Starbucks right there, right dead center. Makes me wonder what's next.
I don't feel that you should drive to Yosemite and say, oh my gosh, I'm going to go get a latte.
So that was part of the podcast. We'll hear my voice going back and forth a bit in these clips. And, you know, the Park Service did respond, and they were skeptical at first about a Starbucks coming in. They came in because Aramark, the concessionaire, revamped things about 2 years ago, and they were revamping a older coffee shop in this place called Yosemite Lodge. And so the Starbucks is there, and people do go there, but there's a large, it goes into this larger conversation about commercialization in these parks that people hold so dear because they think of them in this natural world. And so that was what's going on there. And then, so the second part of the podcast is all about sense of place. Like, how does a Starbucks, how do things like that affect how you experience a park? And I met a woman there named Catherine Keske. She's a professor at UC Merced, and she's actively studying people's experiences right now.
I think an international community and a very large group, and they're, for them, it's posing in front of this majestic wonder, you know, this waterfall. A lot of people, this is probably their first time to Yosemite. Perhaps it'll be the only time that they'll come.
Keske wants to know how the way they're visiting creates memories and how that affects their perception of the park.
We know that there are a lot of crowds in Yosemite, but yet every year we continue to have more and more people. So how does that affect sense of place? Or to some people, it might be without crowds, it wouldn't be the same.
You're listening to clips from a new podcast by CAP Radio environment reporter Ezra David Romero. The podcast is titled Yosemite Land. Episode 1 launches today, with new episodes continuing over the next several Mondays. Are you one of those California kids that took a field trip in grade school to Yosemite?
We didn't take one. My parents were big campers, and so we camped in Yosemite a lot as kids and all over the Sierra Nevada. So that was sort of my first experience with Yosemite, was being there as a kid, driving in the back of the station wagon we had in the very back, looking out back, getting sick because of the fumes, things like that, and camping in the park. And so I have this long history there, to the point, which I'll make in the podcast, that sometimes as someone who's been there so many times and you're dealing with the traffic, the sheer amount of people, that you don't actually want to go anymore.
I was going to ask you that, because the park does bring people who have never seen it, and it might be, as you just said in that clip, the first experience from all over the world. But a lot of visitors are generational, people who did go as kids and then bring their families. And what's talked about more and more, Ezra, is traffic. What was your experience when you were there?
You know, I was there earlier this summer and then once again about a month later, and the first time the traffic was fine. The second time I actually had this great experience where I was coming into the park, a line of like 15 to 20 cars. A ranger was going car by car, asking if you had your annual pass and things like that. And I had a buddy's annual pass, and she let me zoom by all those people. So it was actually quite great experience.
Because the annual pass.
Because I had the annual pass, I didn't have to go do all that again. But, you know, say you're there on a Friday or a Saturday, traffic is pretty terrible. And in the summertime, that can be on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. And to Rhonda Salisbury with the Yosemite Sierra Visitors Bureau, she sums up the issue really well. Let's hear from her.
I mean, in this industry, nobody would say, hey, don't go to Yosemite because it's too crowded. But now we want to say, hey, Yosemite's going to be very crowded between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. why don't you go at 7 a.m. and watch the valley wake up, or go at 4 and watch the valley go to sleep? You know, I mean, it's beautiful in all those times. It's cooler, and you're not going to sit in traffic for several hours.
The reality is that more than 4 million people now visit the park every year, though.
Yeah, tons and tons of people. And visitation is down this year. In 2016, they had about 5 million people visit. And because of fire, because of roads falling out with lots of rain, things like that, the numbers have come down. But there are groups trying to figure out how to diversify that 4 million people. And one of those groups is called Nature Bridge. They are a group that sort of operates like a summer camp. Kids go there for a week. And about a couple years ago, they started to actively think about who their counselors should be or their educators. And so they have this new program where they're trying to get more people of color and as counselors, LGBT people as counselors. And so I went on a hike with this group. Mm. And a guy named Quat Moretz, he's an environmental educator and a group of Sacramento teens. And here's him talking about that program.
Students of color and different identities feel more comfortable when they have an educator that looks like them. And it's not what they might stereotypically think an environmental science teacher is going to look like. So they come here and they say, wow, you know, this guy looks like me. This girl looks like me. Maybe I could do that job. Rather than thinking, oh, this job is for a certain sect of people in the world.
And so the podcast is now up on iTunes. Episode 1 is available. It's called Selfie Trap. And we talk about it a bit more in the episode. There's a moment where we have another professor from UC Merced analyzing my Instagram, talking about how my sense of place has changed there from a kid to now. And so it's going to be fun. Listen, you can go to capradio.org/Yosemite Land. It's going to be pretty cool.
You invoked Ira Glass there a moment. You said it's called Yosemite Land. The episode is Selfie. There's a moment in it when, and I thought, yes, tune in and listen to this, because we're going to meet rock climbers, bear biologists, Native Americans born in the park, realtors who are selling homes.
You'll meet
a
bear in this first episode as well.
I meet a bear?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm in. Thanks so much, Ezra. Again, it's Yosemite Land. Plus, there are photos of Ezra's work in the park and maps. It's all at capradio.org. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the newsroom with more headlines is my colleague Steve Milne. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. Rescue crews will try again today to retrieve the body of Braden Varney. He's the 36-year-old firefighter from Mariposa who died Saturday while fighting the Ferguson fire near Yosemite. Varney was operating a bulldozer for CAL FIRE when it rolled over. His body is in a precarious location in steep terrain, and conditions were too dangerous to allow crews to get close yesterday. Investigators are working to determine further circumstances surrounding Varney's death. And Beth, as Ezra David Romero told you, the Ferguson fire has doubled in size overnight. It has scorched 9,200 acres of brush and timber since it began Friday, and it's still only 2% contained. The wildfire that comes at the peak of tourist season shut down Highway 140. It's a key route into the park, and prompted mandatory evacuations for Yosemite Cedar Lodge and nearby communities. Meanwhile, the Klamathon fire near the California-Oregon border that killed a 72-year-old resident and injured three firefighters is now entirely contained after burning more than 30,000 acres of dry brush. And crews got full control over the County fire that scorched more than 90,000 acres of brush and destroyed 20 structures in Yolo and Napa counties. Investigators said an electric livestock fence that was improperly installed sparked the flames. Sacramento Metro Fire Department is thanking local law enforcement agencies for recovering their stolen fire engine. It was taken from the scene of a fire on Elkhorn Boulevard Saturday. Metro Fire says the engine was recovered in Butte County after a 100-mile pursuit across four counties. Their pursuit finally ended on Highway 70 near Lake Oroville. A man and a woman were arrested. Officials say the truck is worth about $1 million. And the average price for a gallon of gas in the Sacramento area fell 2.5 cents over the past week to $3.52. Tracking service Gas Buddy says the average price is 7 cents lower than a month ago. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Most of last week, I spent at the Community of Writers Conference in Squaw Valley, which is considered among the top writing conferences in the country. One week is focused on poetry. The second week is focused on fiction, nonfiction, memoir, and screenwriting. It draws some of the most talented and successful writers to its staff, and then they in turn work with some of the most hardworking up-and-coming writers across the country. And it's all done in what I found to be a truly remarkable and giving spirit of community. It's a spirit that's been cultivated over the decades, and I tried to capture some of that one evening as we were listening to readings out under the stars. So here's a bit of that flavor from Elizabeth Rosner, John Pula, and Dana Johnson.
My name's Elizabeth Rosner, and I'm here this week up in the Olympic Valley, the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, in this gorgeous bowl nearby Lake Tahoe. The mountains are ringing all around us. It's such a privilege to be in a place where so many of us are striving to make sense of the world through this meager language we have.
My name's John Pula. I'm originally from Minnesota. I live in Seattle now. I came here because of the word community and seeking a community. I'm not a writer professionally or even full-time. I'm an engineer. And so far, that's exactly what I've found, is a people that believe in the written word and its power.
My name is Dana Johnson, and I'm an associate professor of English at the University of Southern California. The first time I came to the Community of Writers, I didn't quite understand what it was. I thought, oh, it's just like a writers' conference, and it'll be nice, and I'll get work done, and I'll meet other writers, and it'll be great. But it actually made me feel as though I was truly entering a community and a history.
The Community of Writers was founded 48 years ago by Oakley and Barbara Hall, Burnett and Mimi Miller, and a few others. The Hall sisters and their extended families have continued the structure and the serving of the writers' community. I want to let you know that some of the Sacramento area contingent was talking a lot about the book by my next guest, fiction writer Jane DeLory. It's her first novel. It's titled The Balcony. It was just released in March, and it encompasses stories of many generations of people whose lives and drama unfold at the same country home in France, in fact, with haunting scenes that play out on the very same balcony. Jane is a native Sacramentan. She taught English and completed her master's in France at the University of Grenoble. And she will be at Time Tested Books in Sacramento tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock. I'm happy to have her in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you. And I love that we have started talking about Squaw at the Squaw Valley Conference, because over 20 years ago, when I was living in France and just starting to write fiction, I actually spent a day at that conference. And it was my first experience of a writing conference, actually. And I remember Oakley Hall spoke and Amy Tan spoke, and I was so inspired by the feeling there. And I went back to France with Oakley Hall's book on novel writing, and that was one of the first books on craft that I ever purchased, and it had a big influence on me. So,
would you say more about how important it is to have a community around you shaping your writing as you're creating a story or a book?
It's so important to, I believe there are some writers who can do it without a community, but I am not of that population. Writing is a very solitary act, but in the end, we are trying to make our work public. And so at a certain point, one has to go from this insular relationship with the manuscript to a draft that can go out into the world. And readers are extremely important, good readers of your work that can give you honest feedback, but also just support, spiritual support, really, in the endeavor of trying to get it right, trying to find some kind of truth. This endeavor that we're all sharing.
This book, as I said, is a compilation of what could stand as individual stories, but they're all wrapped around this estate, and in particular, this balcony.
Did you see a place that inspired this when you were in France? Is this place real, since your book is considered a historical novel?
I started writing these stories, drawing inspiration from a real forest, the forest of Châteauroux, France. My ex-husband's grandparents lived on the edge of the forest, and his grandfather in particular had a very close relationship with that place. And I developed my own relationship with that place through him and then through my morning runs when we would visit. And so over a period of about 15 years, I was writing stories that came from that forest. There are some nuggets of truth, of fact, but then much of it is my imagination. And the estate in the forest includes a manor house and a cottage. And the cottage is based on an actual abandoned cottage. But the manor is all my imagination.
But it's really about this balcony, and you've turned a place into plot by centering on the balcony. Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge. That's interesting. You can turn a character into a plot, but the one constant through all the stories is the balcony.
Oh, I love that. I love that you say it that way. Yeah, you're right. And when I went to put those stories into a book, it was the balcony, it was the estate and the balcony that helped me to do that. That was the organizing principle as I put the manuscript together.
So let's talk a bit about what we're talking about. The very first story in your book helps us know kind of where we are. There's a young American university graduate. She comes to the French manor because she's going to work as an au pair. And she ends up developing a crush on the husband of the family. All of this is not the landscape that was in her dream world, in her fantasy. But take us through quickly how the balcony plays a role in that story.
The balcony, well, the moment that Bridget, I'll call her Bridget, although she's Brigitte in France to her employers, Bridget has a very active imagination, and she's very drawn to stories, and she has an idea of what France will be like. And she ends up in this sort of industrial area that doesn't live up to her expectations. But the balcony on the estate, the balcony that's attached to the manor house where she's staying, has quite a dramatic history because there was a suicide. It's a presumed suicide where a woman fell from the balcony 70 years before. So immediately that captivates her imagination. But also in terms of the book, and when you say place is plot, we come back to that character who jumped or fell from the balcony sometime before.
It's actually a good place to read. Would you start at the very beginning of the first story in the book? And this is Jane DeLorey. Her debut novel is The Balcony. She will be at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento tomorrow night, July 17th at 7 o'clock.
Au pair. In June of 1992, I left Boston for France with everything in front of me. For the next 2 months, I would be an au pair to Hugo and Olga Boyer's daughter, Elodie, at their country estate near Paris. The position came to me through my advisor at Boston University, where I'd just finished a master's degree in French and where Hugo would join the faculty in the fall. As Olga explained to my advisor, who asked me if I was interested, she and Hugo needed a jeune fille to help Elodie practice her English and to watch her mornings while Hugo worked on his book and Olga prepared the house for their departure. I would have a large, sunny room on the top floor and my afternoons and most of the weekends off. Paris, with all of its delights, is only a brief train ride away, Olga wrote to me in French, her handwriting large and baroque. Elodie is an easy child, and her father and I are not monsters. With the money I'd make, I could spend a third month in Paris, and then see how I might stay on in France, where I believed I was meant to live.
Sounds so idyllic. Let me describe your writing, which takes us calmly and gently through a storyline, no big bumps in the road. And I wonder, in reading your stories, whether something is really going to happen, and then all of a sudden, bam. There is a paragraph, that reveals and makes everything whiplash quick, quickly snap into place, and the whole story ends up meaning something else. But it time hops. Elodie will show up in a later story. Hugo will show up in a later story. And I think in some moments, I maybe needed a matrix to keep everybody straight. Have you heard that before?
Yes. And I am always sympathetic to readers. I'm a reader myself. And so, and part of that, when we talked earlier about having a community of writers and having good readers for your fiction or your poetry, is that movement from what the author knows to what the reader needs to know. Because the author knows pretty much everything. So I understand it. I sympathize with readers needing to piece it together. It is very much a novel in stories for me. So I wrote it that way, where each chapter has its own arc, has its own character development, and stands alone. And I've found that problem of putting, you know, everything together is also what many readers tell me they love about the book, that they love the puzzle.
Yeah.
It's probably a challenging book to read over the period of 6 months. And I actually put a timeline on my website. I've been visiting some book clubs, and I tell them, you know, if you're going to be reading the book over a few months, there is a timeline of the estate. So it's a timeline of the property, you know, for readers who want to double check instead of flipping back.
Yeah, you did make the choice not to go chronological, and it goes over many different decades and unrelated families that live in the house at different times. I'm going to add that besides being an associate professor of creative writing and English at the University of Baltimore, you have received a Penn O. Henry Prize and a Pushcart Special Mention and the F. Scott Fitzgerald Story Award. Your story work has been highly recognized and published. At what point did you say, I want to take the leap? I don't want my career to strictly revolve around stories. I want to try the bigger form.
It really came from the book decided what it wanted to be. I wasn't thinking of this as a novel in stories when I laid out the 12 stories that I had been writing. And I hadn't been writing the stories with a specific book in mind. If anything, I thought, oh, a collection. I love linked collections. I love Olive Kittredge. I love Winesburg, Ohio. So that form, of course, influenced me. But it wasn't a conscious decision. But that's just the book that was there. When I laid them out and thought, how does this work as a book? The estate wanted to tell its story. And that meant that I eliminated some stories that I had written that I was attached to. I killed some darlings. And I wrote a pair at the opening. So it was the book knew what it wanted to be. This is what we do. You have to believe in the magic of the process because it's so terrifying. But there is truth to that if you let the story figure itself out or let the book figure itself out, the result is usually what it's supposed to be.
It is the leap of faith in writing, isn't it? You put a character out there and you get quiet and try to listen to what the character has to say, what the character wants to write. Although some people are very linear and structural in their process. Your themes include growing up, as Brigitte is doing, marriage, motherhood, growing old, having affairs, suicide, life, death, weaving all kinds of relationships. Did anything in this book grab you and say, you have to do more with me? Put me in a next book or a next story.
The voice of Brigitte in the opening story is a first-person voice of a woman looking back in middle age, and I am in middle age, and I look back. So that reflective voice is something that I'm playing with more now. Most of my short stories were in third person. I'm very comfortable and I love third person, but I think I personally had to get to a point where I could write in first person because I needed a certain degree of distance. I'm a writer who works with a lot of distance. And so I would say that first person reflective voice is something that I'm still exploring.
Has Brigitte been very close to you in many ways? Is she?
She is, with many, it's, fiction is so funny that way, because I was talking to my daughter. My daughter is a fiction writer. She's goes to a school in that specializes in the literary arts. And we were having this conversation the other day about how when you start to write the story, even if you were starting with a nugget of emotional truth about yourself, the minute that character takes over, it's not you anymore. So I see Bridget, Bridget acts in ways that I didn't act. She's much more, she's much bolder than I am in some ways. But there, yes, there are definitely elements of myself in her.
That was a wonderful concept at the Writers' Conference last week. How much nonfiction is in fiction, but vice versa, how much fiction is in nonfiction, in memoir and some of the other styles. Well, I know everybody's welcoming you back to Sacramento, your parents, John and Cecilia, happy to have you here. Congratulations, you're about to get married too.
Yes.
Yeah, and this first debut novel is getting rave reviews, being called stunning and shimmering and lots of terrific words. So thank you, Jane.
Thank you so much,
Come
Beth.
Back this for the next one.
Really a pleasure. Thank you.
That is Jane DeLurie. Her debut novel is titled The Balcony. She will be at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. We'll post a link to her website. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our team, Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, Mark Jones, and our executive producer, Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.